You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. What is the value of fine craftsmanship? In many ways, it's never been valued more highly as the number of true craft professionals dwindle. Yet there continues to be an irresistible urge to create and make. That urge is at the center of furniture maker Peter Korn's new book, Why We Make Things and Why It Matters, The Education of a Craftsman. Korn is the executive director of the Center for Furniture Craftsmanship, a nonprofit woodworking and design school in Rockport, Maine. His furniture has been exhibited widely in museums and galleries across the country, and he's the author of several books, including Woodworking Basics, Mastering the Essentials of Craftsmanship, which he calls a how-to book. Well, this new book is a why book, and it's much more philosophical as he traces his own development from a semi-skilled carpenter to a fine handmade furniture maker, as well as the sense of meaning and fulfillment derived from craftsmanship and the making of objects that we use in everyday life. It's a really interesting book, Why We Make Things and Why It Matters. Peter Korn is my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Peter Korn, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Rich, thank you for having me.
As the title of your book mentions, this book is an examination of why we like making things in a day and age when really we can purchase anything we desire. There's still something about making something yourself. There will always be those who will want to make the items themselves. Give us a sense of why you decided to write this book. I understand it was because there's nobody really talks about the why of making things. It's more about the how.
Yeah, there were a number of reasons. One of them was that having been a craftsman myself for 40 years, it seems to me I never hear a good way of measuring the value of what one does provided for creative people in any field beyond the sort of values of our mainstream values in our culture of money and fame. And I think that my experience has been that there's a lot more value to having a creative passion and how it enriches your life than can be measured by how much you sell things for or how many people have heard about you doing it.
It's interesting as you look at this particular time, and of course over the course of your career, the idea of being a craftsman has waxed and waned. But right now at the same time, we're perhaps no more obsessed with that idea of becoming famous and how much you can sell something for. And at the same time, there's this other movement that seems to be growing again for that craftsman for craftsman's sake, or craftsperson, or making things for their own sake.
Yeah, first of all, I should say that as a craftsman who came of age in the 1960s and 70s, I was part of a large demographic movement into craft, and that is now, by art historians, called the Studio Craft Movement. And we were a large cohort of people who were really interested in craft as a way to develop our own virtuosity. I like to say that we confused virtuosity with virtue, thought that by getting really good at these things, we would become better people, which I think may be true to some extent, but not to what we imagined. And that, like all art historical movements, that has now moved through the culture and is in decline, just like Art Deco or Art Nouveau or Abstract Expressionism or anything like that. But what's wonderful is there is this rise of something called the maker movement, which is young people getting excited all over again about making physical objects with their own imaginations and skills, and they're sort of starting off reinventing the wheel again. They're doing it in some sort of a different social context than we were.
You know, it's interesting. It's kind of like there's this cycle. The arts and crafts movement at the beginning of the century, again, the studio craft movement in the 60s and 70s, and now the maker movement. You write in the book, the fact is craftsmanship, the idea of craftsmanship for craftsmanship's sake, is a pretty new idea. It was basically you made things and that was it. It was only in the 20th century when we began to look at this idea of craft and design.
Yeah, when the idea of craft, and no matter how you think of it, the actual idea of craft wasn't invented till the 1870s by the British Arts and Crafts Movement, and their idea of a craftsman was someone's employee who would build a product that was designed by someone else from start to finish in a healthy working environment. They were trying to invent craft as an alternative way of making goods that would be better for the workers and therefore better for society than industrial working conditions. But by the time craft got to my generation, 100 years later, we were really interested in not only this ideal of the self-sufficient, you know, craftsman working in lovely conditions, but also in we were interested in being self-expressive and self-employed and self-actuated. And what had happened in those 100 years is the idea that we have as a society about what the self is and how independent it is had changed radically. So we just came to craft from the time and place when we were born, picked it up, and looked at it as a way to achieve all these personal goals.
Now, of course, I love the way you wrote about how the final epiphany about how that idea of how a great craftsman doesn't necessarily equal a great person came about. And it came about in the early 80s when you met a very famous ceramic artist.
Yes. Peter Volkus he's no longer alive, but he's considered sort of the founding father of contemporary American ceramics. And he made among other ways in which he made his mark in the 1950s was he would make really well-made vessels, but then he would poke a hole in the bottom. So they suddenly became sculpture or conceptual instead of vessels. And because there's always been this wall between the fine arts and the applied arts, and he was, in a way, bridging it. Well, so he was this legend, and then by the time I met him, he also had a tremendous reputation for not taking very good care of himself. And he pulled up to a symposium at the Anderson Ranch Art Center. Someone opened the van door for him, and this was in the morning, he fell out the door, flat to the ground, either inebriated or otherwise incapacitated. And that was, you know, there I was thinking that craftsmanship was about getting your life together, and there was the most famous craftsman I would ever meet, and he was a mess. That was a lesson.
Now, give us the short version of your story of how you became a craftsman. You were going to college, and all of a sudden you took a summer job working as a carpenter on Nantucket Island.
Well, kind of like that. I went to college. I studied history at the University of Pennsylvania. And all the time I was in school, I felt like I was living life secondhand, and real life had to be somewhere else. So right after college, I moved to Nantucket Island, which was not the wealthy enclave it is today. It was a really quiet, forgotten place. And the first job that came along was as a carpenter. And I had never worked with my hands, and I came from a family where my dad was a lawyer and my mom was an historian. They didn't know anyone who worked with their hands, and their social milieu looked down a lot on working with your hands. And I found working with my hands I loved it. I mean, I didn't love it the first month or two when I was terrible at it, but as I got better at it and learned which end of the nail you hit, I definitely found that being able to take physical materials and see what you've done at the end of the day and what it feels like when your hands start developing skills, and we're all great, but also there's so much cognitive problem solving in carpentry that your mind is engaged at the same time as your hands. So that was how I got into woodworking. And then 2 years later, I built a cradle for some friends, and that was truly my first epiphany. 3 days in a barn, and at the end of that, all I wanted to do was rediscover what seemed like the lost art of furniture making.
And in fact, for the most part, it was sort of a lost art of furniture making. And now, granted, there were people out there making wooden furniture out there, but it was I was really struck by the fact when you began making furniture, you were kind of at the tail end of the Nakashimas and the Maloofs and all that sort of stuff that really moved you up pretty quick. I mean, as far as, you know, getting a reputation.
Furniture making, woodworking was a really small world at the time I entered it. There were 5 or 10 known craftsmen in the country with reputations, but I didn't know of any of them because craft had a much smaller presence then, is the best way to say it. Fine Woodworking magazine didn't start coming out till a year after I picked up a hammer and a mallet. So it was kind of like learning in a void at first. And then the studio craft movement and the studio furniture movement, which is what we call it, burgeoned in the 70s and 80s into the 90s. It grew, and tool companies like Delta or Black & Decker or DeWalt were seeing double-digit growth in tool sales every year because it not only grew wildly among people like myself taking up professionally, but even more so among people taking it up as a hobby. And then around 2000 or so, all the growth went out of that area, it had its moment, and then it slowed down. But now at our school, because I run the school called the Center for Furniture Craftsmanship in Maine, we're starting to see more young people coming into our classes again, and it's quite exciting.
Well, one of the things, as you began your career of furniture making, I know your father, you referred to him earlier, he said, you're going to be intellectually unfulfilled. In fact, a good part of this book is showing that the opposite is the case, that your materials, you're having this incredible conversation with your materials as you're working with them.
Yes, I think that I enjoyed being a carpenter, and I did it for 2 years. But it was really when I started to design the things I was making, which is when I became a furniture maker, that I became fully engaged as a human being in what I was doing. You know, there's a cliche in craft said by a British potter, Bernard Leach, that craft engages the head, the heart, and the hand, the whole person. It's really true. And so I have found that the challenge of design added to the problem solving and the physical skills is what makes craft just a fully absorbing activity.
That's really interesting that you say that, because I think a big part of this book is, you know, woodworking is a solitary endeavor, but in fact, to do it well, you have to be able to negotiate the world of other people as well as that private world. And I think one of the things you see at your center and in the course of teaching, see, a lot of people just want to get away from the world and be that furniture maker, but you can't do it without having the people skills.
Yes, we get lots and lots of students who are so much like I was 40 years ago, where they have this dream that they're going to develop the skills, and they're going to have a lovely workshop behind the house, and every morning they're going to walk out there and design and build incredibly beautiful furniture one piece at a time, and then someone's just going to show up and pay them a lot of money for it so they can build the next piece and sustain their lifestyle. And that is just so not true. And what we tell them, even from before they register for the longer courses, is if you're going to take this up as a career, you have to treat it as a business, and you have to put at least as much work into marketing and other aspects of the business as you do into the fun parts, the making and the designing. And yes, being successful in a craft involves relating to your community and also making things that are valued by your community. You can't just make something that seems brilliant to you in isolation and then demand that the world wants it. The more you're tuned into what's happening around you and to what's happening in your own field, whether it's ceramics or glass or wood, the more likely what you make is going to be exploring the same questions other people are interested in. Because I do think when we go into the studio to make something, we're really taking questions in with us that we're asking and trying to find the answers to, and that's the creative process. You don't know what you're going to come up with until you've done it.
Well, that's one of the other things you write about craftsmanship is it's the process of thinking with things. And in the course of the book, you write about your writing desk and a coffee table made in the style of a famous British craftsman. And you use that as sort of, these are the objects in which, you know, when you think about the process of actually making them and all the decisions that went into it and all the ways in which the wood speaks to you, and really you have this conversation with these objects as you're creating them, although it's
right.
Interior.
Well, let me tell you what the central personal epiphany was that led to the writing of this book, which is I started off as a craftsman showing my work in craft shows, and then after 6 years in 1980, I started showing in art galleries. And when you show in an art gallery, you have to write artist statements. And what I was writing in my artist statement around 1980 is that I was trying to make furniture that had the qualities of simplicity and integrity and grace. And those are still my design goals. And 10 years later, in 1990, I was in a writing workshop to write an artist mission statement with a critic named Arlene Raven. And in that workshop, I realized that the reason I had become a furniture maker in the first place was because I thought that by acquiring these skills and practicing them, I was going to cultivate the qualities of integrity and simplicity and grace in myself. And then I realized, yeah, the reason I'm a furniture maker, and I think actually the people engage in all creative arts today by extension, is we go into the studio not because the world needs another chair or symphony or plate. It's because we expect to somehow feel different at the other end of the creative gauntlet when we come out having made the thing. And it's because when we're making something that hasn't existed before, we learn. We learn about ourselves. We learn about materials. Furniture, which I'm interested in, is a prescription for the life to be lived around it. So we learn about the nature of what a good life might be when we're designing furniture. We're looking for a piece that tells us something. I think creative work is very much a thought process, and one of the illusions that I had going into the book was that we think with words. And now I realize thought takes place in many ways, and words are just one medium we use. And I know I'm going on, but one more thing. The reason I know that is there are so many times a day when I know exactly what I want to say, but I can't find the words for it because the thought is there and the words aren't. And that's how I know that thought takes place at a level of consciousness well below language.
My guest today is Peter Korn. He is the executive director for the Center for Furniture Craftsmanship in Maine. He's been a furniture maker for 40 years, and he's the author of Why We Make Things and Why It Matters, The Education of a Craftsman. It's published by David Godine, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, you mentioned the little cradle you made was the first thing, and actually there's a little model of that, and that was a beautiful cradle, and it was 2 years in. But what I gather was that it took a while to find your own voice as a craftsman. Because you have all these different styles, you have hundreds of years of ways of making chairs, of making tables, of making coffee tables and tables of all sorts, desks. Talk about finding your own voice as a craftsman.
Absolutely. For myself, I really set out to learn the skills of woodworking. I never thought about design at first. And yet I designed each new piece because I would know what skill I wanted to learn next, like using a spokeshave or cutting dovetails, and so I would design the piece to have that skill involved. And over time, I discovered I loved design. But by the time I'd been a furniture maker for perhaps 6 years or so, I was becoming aware that if I was actually going to make a sustainable living, I had to have a recognizable aesthetic that people would like, and they could look at a piece of furniture and say, oh, that must be by Peter Korn. If it was going to have more value than the equivalent piece from, well, today we would say IKEA, but then it was other stores. So there was being self-employed, there was some sort of a financial pressure to find my own voice and style. But now that I'm further along, I see also that finding one's own voice and style is so much, I'll say this differently. I think that certainly for me, practicing my craft has always been a process of self-discovery and becoming, especially when I was younger and trying to forge an adult self. And part of forging a self, I think, can be developing a style of one's own, finding the voice that makes sense to you in terms of the aesthetics of what you're doing.
And while at the beginning it was the idea of financial pressures, the lasting value in finding your own voice is, that again, that inner aesthetic.
Yeah, and it's also not having your voice, but explore. For me, physical objects, each physical object that I make or anyone else makes, is just that person is going through a lifelong thought process, and as an artist, they're going through a process of learning and getting better over time. And in each piece, they're exploring ideas, and the piece is the concrete snapshot of their ideas at that moment. And then when they go to the next piece, their ideas evolve a little further and a little further, and each piece is a snapshot. So that process of having your ideas evolve through making things is what the creative life is.
Yeah. At some point, I think you wrote that, you had some success, you were showing in galleries, and then you were kind of on the tail end of that furniture movement as part of the studio craft movement, and then tastes change, and you found it was difficult to make to continue on or to make a leap in how you designed your own pieces. I think you began to do that later with this. You show the wonderful process of creating a one rail chair and the prototypes involved in it. But did you struggle at times with that moving, you know, the fact that these things sort of snowball down a slope and you have to...
Yeah. What happened was that I was always very interested in furniture with Shaker simplicity. And when I started in the 1970s, that was of interest to galleries, buyers, and, you know, magazines and newspapers. It was of interest. But in the 1980s, as my field matured, that became old hat. And people, woodworkers, furniture makers started exploring contemporary trends like postmodernism and that sort of thing. And that's where the interest of galleries and publications and buyers went. So I found myself on sidelined, but I was unable, or at least uninterested, in changing my own design to fit the dictates of the time, because I was exploring, I guess, what you would say was my truth.
You know, one of the things that you write about is you talk about this struggle with the values between contemporary art, which is always valuing something new, and really in contemporary it's about the the idea of the art as much as the art itself, and between craft. Is there really that big a division, or should there be a big division? Because the same amount of thinking goes into, you know, from this book, it reminds me that if in coming up with a really wonderful, say, a Shaker inspired design for a chair, but it has its own design, the same amount of thinking is going into that and to some conceptual piece of art.
Well, we are all caught in a hundreds of year old cultural prejudice that says that fine art is a product of the mind or somehow related to the mind, and decorative arts and crafts are related to the body and non-intellectual. And from my point of view, having observed and thought about this, the work of designing a piece of furniture and building it can be just as much an exploration of what it is to be a human being and how we ought to live as painting and sculpture are. So, I have a very different premise for understanding the arts and crafts than you'd find in most mainstream literature.
Do you feel like that perception is changing, the idea that there is the same amount of thinking in the applied arts as in the fine arts?
I don't find it's changing. I mean, back in the arts and crafts movement in England in the 1870s, Ruskin and Morris were not only saying this is a false divide, craft is as important as art, they were actually saying craft is more important than art. But that idea has never really taken hold. The division's been there a long time. People have been fighting it for a long time. I hope that what I've written here will add to an understanding of how craft can be a deep way of thinking, and we'll see what happens.
My guest today is Peter Korn, the executive director of the Center for Furniture Craftsmanship, a furniture maker for many years, and the author of his most recent book is Why We Make Things and Why It Matters, The Education of a Craftsman. His previous book was a how-to book, really, Woodworking Basics. But this is more of a why we make things. And in our last couple of minutes, tell us a little about the Center for Furniture Craftsmanship, because one of the things you did throughout your life, and you document this in the book, is, you know, you've been a teacher, you've helped other people sort of find their own voice through making things, and now the Center for Furniture Craftsmanship is really your baby, and it's what you're doing now. What happens at the center?
The center is a woodworking school in Rockport, Maine, and we have about 400 students a year, and 25% of what we do are short courses for amateur woodworkers, and about 3/4 of what we do are longer professional training for woodworkers, mostly furniture making, some wood turning. I founded the school, but it has grown wonderfully. It's a nonprofit institution, and we've gotten to a point after 22 years where we have a great staff and board, so I've made myself dispensable, which was always my goal, but I hope they don't dispense with me too quickly. And one of the things that I can't say it's unique about the school, but it's certainly foundational, I think, to its success, is that because I think that creativity is so important to the satisfaction in making things, even in the basic woodworking courses, you're still designing your projects. We're starting to help give people the conceptual design tools so they can learn how to come up with an idea and then make it real in a wonderful way.
Are you continuing to work with wood yourself as far as new designs, or does this school keep you so busy you have little time for this now?
Well, yes, the school keeps me hugely busy, as did writing the book, of course.
Yeah.
And so I make about one piece of furniture a year. The last one I made last year was a new dining table for myself after 30 years of using a table that was so rickety, water would be splashing out of the glasses quite regularly. It's a very simple, straightforward table, but I had such a good time doing it.
In the book, you talk about the idea of writing at your writing desk, which you made. Can you talk about the satisfaction of eating a meal on a table that you designed and built yourself?
Yeah, it's an interesting satisfaction. I mean, and sometimes you're not aware that you made the table at all while you're eating there. But sometimes I'll look at the end grain on the end of the tabletop, which I put what's called a thumbnail edge on with hand tools, and then sand it up nicely. And just that quarter sawn oak end grain is so beautiful there. Just little details like that. It's just nice living around beauty. And there are aspects of this table, simple as it is, that I find beautiful.
Now, as a furniture maker, do you focus on the minute flaws, or do you tend to look for those things that really, you know, that you say, oh, that came out so well?
Okay, I have learned after 40 years that almost no one in the world but me will see the flaws. So my eyesight's getting worse, so they do not bother me nearly as much. Unfortunately, in that regard, so many of my friends are fine furniture makers that the people who come over to dinner tend to be the only people in the world who will see the flaws.
Well, this is a really interesting book, and it's more than just for a craftsperson. It's more about a way of finding a path of creativity. And I think one of the things early in the book you write is the fact that for some person it might be furniture making, another person it might be gardening, another person it might be cooking, and the process is in some ways much the same.
I think so, and I really, bottom line, what I think is that whether you do these things as an amateur or as a professional doesn't matter, but the place where I have found and noticed that we find meaning and fulfillment in life of the sort that we all seem basically hungry for is just when you have an idea and you do the hard work of bringing it into reality in any area or any field. That is when we're inhabiting our ability as creators, and it's a wonderful way to be fully human.
All right. The name of the book, Why We Make Things and Why It Matters. Peter, thank you very much for your time.
You're very welcome.
Fine furniture maker Peter Korn. He's the author of Why We Make Things and Why It Matters, The Education of a Craftsman. It's published by David Godine. He's also the founder and executive director for the Center for Furniture Craftsmanship, a nonprofit woodworking and design school in Rockport, Maine. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed any of our recent episodes, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. Just find Studio Tulsa on our page, and you can scroll through our most recent shows and search our archives. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.